This is the KPTC Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. As the novel coronavirus known as COVID-19 wreaks havoc upon the world, Jefferson County, with fewer than 24 confirmed cases so far, has been a relatively safe haven from a storm that has elsewhere overwhelmed hospitals and morgues. But how long will we be spared? Can we avert the kind of tragedy that has hit Italy, Spain, and New York? This week on the Compass, we once again talk with Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke about how the Olympic Peninsula might come through the biggest health crisis of our time. So now, let's go inside the Compass.
You've just come from a phone conference, I gather, with the other public health officials in the state, and I'm just curious to hear what was on the agenda in that meeting and what you learned.
This is a really fast moving kind of response, or the technology is literally changing every week. So among the things we reviewed this week is there's some new technology that we think is going to allow us to improve the speed of sampling, first of all, for COVID-19. You know, right now, as most people know, we have these drive-up centers and a nurse or a medical assistant in full protective guard samples you, and then you drive off. There's been some research out of the Everett Clinic that says we can use a new kind of nasal swab that the patient uses on themselves. So they drive up and we give you a little kind of foam sampling device, which you stick up your own nose on both sides and then hand it to the nurse and then drive off. And one of the advantages of that, it'll help us save this personal protective equipment that is in such scarce supply. And so, and it appears that we can do higher volume testing with that. There's also some new tests that are out there, testing devices that can be used in hospitals. And there's something we've been waiting for a long time that tests whether a person is immune to the coronavirus. And there's actually two kind of antibodies we look for. One that's sort of formed right away and says you've recently had the infection, and then another antibody that says you've developed the long-term immunity to it. So those are both out. And then the other big thing on this call was we heard a presentation from an organization that's getting a lot of national attention, and it's called the IHME, the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. And this is a group out of the University of Washington that has become one of the world's leaders in modeling how the pandemic is going to play out, when the surges are going to hit, and whether we're going to have enough hospital beds and ICU beds and ventilators. Since this is based in the University of Washington, we have special access to it. And we had one of the lead modeler went over the Washington State data with us. And it looks like that here on the Olympic Peninsula, we're about 2 weeks behind what's going to happen in Seattle. Seattle is probably going to peak in the next 10 days or so, by about the middle of the month. And that's going to tend to happen at the end of April or the very early part of May. And so, you know, essentially what we have to expect is day by day by day, things are going to get worse over the next month here in Jefferson and Clallam counties.
One of the things that I've heard, and tell me if I'm wrong, is where you started to take measures, I mean, mitigation, community mitigation measures like sheltering in place and, you know, like people self-isolating and so on. You know, how early you do that also has a lot of effect on, you know, how bad it gets at the top of the surge.
Indeed. And Washington State instituted their mitigation measures relatively early compared to other states. And one of the reasons was it hit here first.
Right.
And when we finally had a test that we could use to test for it, we found out almost immediately it was widespread. And so we we kind of kicked into action and started doing mitigation really at the beginning of March and just tightened it up week by week by week, so that by the time other states were considering it, that the West Coast was sort of in full-blown mitigation. And we think that's why the curve is much more flattened in Washington State than it is in some other areas like New York or Alabama, Florida. These states that started late are probably going to come to regret that decision because they're much more likely to have the surge of medical demand overwhelm their medical system's capacity to deal with it, kind of like what's going in tragically in New York right now.
It seems also, though, that, you know, we might hope that Jefferson County and Clallam County, both of which got started to shut things down before we even had a case of community spread here. And I don't know, how is the curve in Jefferson County looking compared to your expectations a few weeks ago?
It's certainly going in many ways like I expected, and that is that, you know, we thought that it would be introduced by people going back and forth to Seattle, you know, many of whom had to do that. They work in Seattle. They work in Seattle and they live in Jefferson County. And then, as we expected, because it's so contagious and because a significant number of people either have very mild illness or they have no symptoms at all, more and more the research is revealing to us that is a significant part of the spread, is this so-called asymptomatic spread. And so that pretty much guarantees that this virus will move all throughout the state of Washington and throughout the country, for that matter. And I think, though, we have reason to believe that it's happening fairly slowly. And one thing that we've done in Jefferson County, we have done a lot of testing. There's been over 500 tests where we've gotten the test results back, and we're running a little under 5% of the tests are positive. And that contrasts to much higher levels in the I-5 corridor countries and counties, and statewide, it's about 7.5% of the tests done are turning out to be positive. So probably the rates are somewhat lower on the Olympic Peninsula, and we benefit from our rural, the spread out rural nature of housing. You know, we have kind of a natural social distancing in rural areas that they don't have in urban areas, you know, where people live very closely together.
Yeah, actually, my program this week focused on one of the areas where people are really concentrated, which, of course, is like in the homeless shelters. And I heard that Port Angeles has come up with a solution for that, but I gather that we're still kind of struggling to find a solution.
Well, no, actually, I think we're moving along pretty expeditiously. The plan has to be approved by the local health officer, which I did yesterday.
Oh, you did?
The day I got it, I reviewed it and approved it. So
what's the plan?
Well, essentially, we looked at different options, and really the best option, both from an isolation and quarantine standpoint and for the welfare of the people that we were housing, was to use existing hotels and motel space. It's something that they're empty. Nobody's staying in them. So these businesses are eager
to have the business.
You know, yeah. And it really meets the criteria that we want from an isolation quarantine standpoint. And that is, everyone's got their own room. Everyone's got their own bathroom.
Right.
We don't really want to house people in big open rooms like shelters do, because it's almost impossible to prevent the spread of an infection from person to person if everyone's sharing the same bathrooms and utilities and all of that. So I think it's kind of the best we're going to be able to do is to use our existing hotel stock. And then we're also looking at other contingency plans. You know, if we have a hospital overflow or things like that, we've got other sites in the county that we're looking at. But we're hoping not to do that. So far, the modeling says that if we really strictly keep up the social distancing and keep things really locked down for the next month, we'll be able to keep within our existing hospital capacity. Or if we have to transfer people out of county, there will be room in other hospitals for them to be seen.
So that figure you gave me of like, you know, 10 days or so of continued increase in number of cases, that was for the I-5 corridor, or was that what you're expecting here in Jefferson County?
For here, we're expecting, it's as you look at the curve, it just goes up and up for the whole month of April, and then it peaks right at the end of April, and then we'll start to drop. And what those curves really are representing is the hospital bed demand, because we know that about 20% of people who test positive for it, this infection, need some level of hospital care. We think actually that the people that we are testing represent just kind of the tip of the iceberg. There are anywhere from 5 to 10 times more people. So for instance, in Jefferson County, we currently have 19 confirmed positive cases, but the true number of those that have infection, often very mild, is somewhere between 5 and 10 times that much. So it's 100 to 200 people are probably infected. We only know about 19 of them.
There's been about, 9 or 10 cases of community infection that you've identified. How successful have you been in figuring out, like, where they got it?
Well, you never know for sure unless they have a direct exposure to a confirmed case.
Right.
And even then, you don't absolutely know for sure. One of the extreme challenges we've had is the testing data has been so delayed that sometimes we have been waiting anywhere from 10 to 14 days to get the test result.
Oh my God.
That's 14 days we've lost in terms of doing contact tracing. The way we tried to compensate for that is when a person gets tested, we in essence tell them, you have this until proven otherwise.
Right.
So we have everyone who's tested go into isolation, and then we try to have them let all their contacts know that they might be infected too. And with that, we've had cases where by the time we got the lab test back, they were already recovered. So what we prefer to do, and now we're starting to get tests back in a day or two, which is much better.
Oh, yeah.
And then we make sure that the person who's infected is in isolation. And then we do a real aggressive effort to identify all the places they've been and everyone they may have been in contact with. And we have a team of 5 investigators who are working on this. So 3 of them are nurses and then actually 2 other folks that are doing these investigations. And it's a really skilled team. So we're lucky for a county of this size to have this many skilled investigators. And we're trying to use it as aggressively as we can, because this is something we know works. If we can stop the people who have the infection from spreading it to someone else, and if we can alert their contacts that they may develop it so that they're in isolation at the time they develop symptoms, then the infection stops with those people. It doesn't spread on to someone else.
So how are we doing now on the availability of tests? Like, you know, we had a scare at the radio station that actually could have threatened our ability to stay on the air because one of our virus response team came down with some kind of virus and she was unable to get tested. I mean, so she had been in close contact with the station manager and with various other people. So everyone she'd been in contact with, you know, went into self-quarantine because there's a certain number of key personnel that if, you know, like they're not okay, then the station would have to go off the air. It seemed to me that was kind of a crucial shortage of tests there, that somebody in that kind of position couldn't get tested.
The testing availability is really starting to ramp up. We were just told today on the call that Washington State's able to do about 10,000 tests a day, which is a huge improvement from a month ago. And then that's going to double to 20,000 tests a day within 2 weeks. The maddening aspect of it is one of the greatest shortages right now is not the test, but the specimen collection kit that you send the test to the lab with. So simple Dacron swabs and this liquid called viral transport media, those are in critically short supply. And so that's what's limiting our number of tests is we can't get enough specimen collection kits to send the tests. It's why the hospital has been sort of rationing their tests according to the state priority so we don't run out of specimen collection kits, because we need them for people who are seriously ill or people that are sort of high risk or our highest priority people to test, like healthcare workers and people with chronic medical conditions and people who work in long-term care facilities. So that's another shortage that should have never happened. Eventually, it'll be fixed. It doesn't take high technology to, you know, make a bunch of swabs. It's just all of these things illustrate how poorly prepared the United States was for this kind of pandemic, even though people have been warning government officials for, you know, since the mid-2000s, literally since 2004. You know, the SARS epidemic in 2003 was the wake-up call. And ever since then, we've been saying that a pandemic is not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. You know, we're a culture that does not keep inventories of anything anymore. You know, people somehow believe that they could just get whatever they needed the next day from Amazon, and it just doesn't work that way. I think what people don't realize is a pandemic influenza strain could be even worse than this. If they can imagine it, we grade influenza pandemics on a 5-point scale. And on that scale, what we're going through right now is about grade 3. And the 1918 influenza pandemic was a grade or a class 4. And there can be up to class 5 pandemics. So we have to get prepared as a society for these kind of things. And I mean, the more you look at it, the more disheartening it is. I learned about a week ago that, you know, we did have a national stockpile of masks. It's just that we used them in 2009 and we never replaced them. So it doesn't do much good to do finger pointing now because we're in the midst of an emergency, but we really have to learn the lesson or we're just going to keep repeating this over and over again.
Let's turn back to some of the lessons that have been learned about this virus. There was a choir that I'm sure you heard about from Mount Vernon where they thought they were being careful in early March. There were 60 people. 45 of them came down with COVID-19 afterwards, and two of those people are now dead. And it seems like a really prime example of kind of asymptomatic spread of this. So it seems like somehow people are shedding virus and catching the disease, and it's spreading silently through populations. And actually, Case Kolff this morning sent out an email to a bunch of people saying, I think that it is imperative that everybody should be wearing a mask, not an N95 mask, but whenever you go out in public, wear a mask. And then when you get home, treat the mask as though it were contaminated and put it into a hot oven at 180 degrees or wash it with soap and hang it out in the sun. But, you know, he's sort of suggesting a measure where people treat everything as being, you know, possibly contaminated. Do you have any comment on that?
People will be hearing a lot about that. The at a federal level, the CDC is reconsidering that issue. And I think the strongest argument for public masking is this asymptomatic shedding kind of issue. We used to think about 10% of the spread was from asymptomatic shedding. It's probably considerably higher. Current estimates are 20 to 40% wow. of cases are being spread by people who don't even know they're having infection. And we also have evidence to say that you don't have to be coughing or sneezing to generate droplets. That loud talking or shouting or singing, as in the case of the Mount Vernon cluster, can be enough to eject droplets into the air and maybe even cause these short-lived aerosols. And the difference between droplets and aerosols, it's a matter of size of the particles. So droplets are usually bigger than 5 microns, and they're heavy enough to fall to the ground under the influence of gravity. But aerosols are even smaller particles, and they can float for a while in the air. And so they're more of a risk to be inhaled. And we know for certain that there are aerosols that are generated during medical procedures and actually probably dental procedures where you're using high-speed drills or suction machines. Those we know definitely generate aerosols. We're not so sure about human contact, but wearing a mask will tend to trap those droplets or aerosols. So if you wear a mask in public, you are certainly protecting other people from your droplets. And if more people wear masks in public, the public spaces will probably be less contaminated. What's less certain is how much the mask protects you. And that has a lot to do with the mask design. Is, you know, simple two-layer cotton masks probably do not give a lot of personal protection to someone. But people are being very innovative, and they're producing these very nice, tight-fitting masks and masks that will accommodate a filter layer. So they have a sleeve that you can put a filter layer in. And potentially, those offer some protection. You know, it's untested at this point. But the only thing that we're really concerned about is that we don't want people who are wearing masks in public to be competing with the medical masks that are going to healthcare workers and first responders. Yeah, because we have a critical shortage of those, and we don't want that to get any worse.
Do we have a critical shortage of them now in Jefferson County?
We think we probably have a 3 to 4 week supply. And,
you know, like, what are you anticipating to be the maximum demand put on our hospital?
We really don't know. It depends on what model you look at. You know, unfortunately, we just don't have accurate enough data to make those trends. Right. What we're going by is the University of Washington modeling group. They have some modeling data for the non-urban counties in Washington state, and we're going by those. And what they're saying is, if we're very careful, if people use maximum kind of social distancing mitigations, that will stay within our current capacity. You know, we might have to do some ICU transfers to other facilities, but Washington State is looking like we can manage the surge if we don't let up. And we intensify our efforts to prevent transmission, because we really are slowing down the transmission by the kind of behavior changes that are either being forced on people or they're adopting voluntarily.
Right. So when do we know that it's safe to come out? When can we come out from under our rocks? How many days or weeks need to pass where there's no new cases and people have recovered, you know, like before we say, all right, well, we can go out to the movies again?
You know, it's not necessarily that safe under a rock. what we really want people to do is keep their distance from non-household members. That's really where the danger is.
Right.
It's other people, and it's people who might be carrying the infection without even knowing it, or it's people who have moved through the environment before you and, you know, coughed into their hands and then touched a doorknob, right, or some high-touch surface in a grocery store. So that's where the risks are. And the better people get at managing those risks, you know, what I've been telling people, ultimately, what you need to learn to do to live in this new world is to behave like a hospital worker does.
Right.
That's our chosen profession, is to work in these areas where we concentrate all the worst infectious diseases going on in the community, and we put them all together in one building. And we go room to room to room, taking care of these people. And we know how to stop that spread. We almost never spread things from person to person to person in hospitals because of these, you know, hand washing and cover your cough and personal protective equipment and all of that stuff. It's just that to be able to move around in society and reopen businesses and do things like that, we've got to learn to do it in a way that does not transmit this infection. And I think we can do it, but it's a steep learning curve. And right now we're using very crude, you know, stay home techniques because we have to break the cycle of transmission, or otherwise we're going to have people dying who didn't need to die. They're just going to die for lack of medical care. And nobody wants that to happen.
Right. But I mean, so to repeat my question, though, so it's like, you know, how many days or weeks after the last patient has like left the emergency room and you have no more like cases showing up? I mean, at what point do we sort of like sound the all clear and let people like go back to restaurants and so on?
Well, I can tell you what the modeling data that we just looked at today shows is that, you know, if we keep up these strict social distancing kind of interventions, not just through the month of April, but through the month of May too, that things will drop off by the end of May. And that right. doesn't say it'll completely go away, but we will be over the surge. And then there's whether it comes back again. You know, there's a lot of evidence that says this will come back in the fall, kind of like influenza. But what's really going to determine that is how many people got infected and became immune.
Right.
You know, if 40% of the people who are getting it don't even know they have it, population immunity will build up a lot faster than we previously thought. But whether it comes back or not will depend almost entirely on how many people are left who are susceptible. And the virus is not going away. This is going to be circulating on this planet for years and years to come, just like influenza circulates. It's just there's too much of it out in the world now for it to go away.
With Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. In order to more closely cover the fast-breaking COVID-19 crisis, the Compass will be moving to a new schedule in which each week's show will originate on Saturday at noon and repeat the following Monday at noon and 5 p.m. If you value the local coverage KPTZ has given the current crisis, please show your appreciation by going to the kptz.org website and utilizing the Donate Now feature. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.